This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
We don't know if the outcome will be regarded as free and fair, whether it will be destabilizing, whether it will provoke another round of instability.
That's J. Stephen Morrison of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, talking about the impact of the DRC election on its Ebola outbreak. Details next. Also, a major case of financial fraud concerning a $2 billion loan is unraveling in Mozambique. And 48 people have died after an attack early this week in Burkina Faso ignited widespread intercommunal violence. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the DRC's presidential election has added a new layer of complexity to the effort to bring the Ebola outbreak under control in the country's east. The area has been a conflict zone for more than two decades and is an opposition stronghold with a strong mistrust of the central government. That and long-held traditions have translated into community resistance to the international effort to fight Ebola. More than 600 confirmed and suspected cases of the deadly virus has already been detected, making it the worst outbreak since the West Africa epidemic that killed more than 11,000 people from 2014 to 2016. Election violence has further hampered the Ebola fight and is raising questions about the future of an already traumatized area, traumatized by conflict, and a country that has been regularly racked by violence since its founding in 1960. My colleague Paul Alexander talked with J. Stephen Morrison of the Center for Strategic and International Studies about the impact of the election and the best and worst case scenarios.
We don't know if the outcome will be regarded as free and fair, whether it will be destabilizing, whether it will provoke another round of instability. We don't have enough vaccine to do universal vaccine coverage. So we're staring at a very uncertain situation. There's no magic solutions. There's no clear pathway out from this. And it's highly dangerous and more complicated and more difficult in many respects than what we saw in West Africa in 2014-2015, which was, as you recall, awfully dangerous and frightening.
So what do you see as the best and worst case scenarios emerging at this time?
Well, a best case scenario would be we get through this election and things calm down and the standard services and operations in trying to arrest the outbreak are able to be reinstituted at a more normal level, and the violence against providers and the overall general violence in the environment declines. And you could return to the vision that WHO has been advocating since the very beginning, which is this is going to be tough. We know it's going to be tough. It's going to take longer than we thought, but give us 6 months, 8 months, and we think we can finish the work. Another scenario is the violence does not abate. Targeted violence against health workers results in a decision by many of those to shut down operations or to convert to a whole different plan B. So far, there hasn't been a clear solution to addressing and arresting the threat posed by the Allied Democratic Forces. There's been some efforts made, only very partially successful, by the UN forces and by the Congolese forces to take them on, but ADF has proved very resilient and very able to strike back. Under a worst-case scenario, ADF comes roaring back and is highly disruptive, and that further aggravates an already very difficult security situation. Under a more positive scenario, the UN forces under their intervention brigade undertake a very forceful operation and are successful. The other is the community resistance. If there's no effective strategy undertaken to repair that problem in a more systematic and more deliberate way, you're blocked. You know, transmission will not be arrested brought under control without the trust, cooperation, confidence of the communities.
So what role do you think that the whole political situation there has played?
That's the dominant story. That preempts consideration of many other issues, and I think it's one that becomes the central preoccupation, and it colors the response on the Ebola outbreak in many ways. There's no appetite in Kinshasa for really giving top priority to the Ebola outbreak. If the government is thrown into disarray and we're not sure who's governing this country, that has grave complications for the leadership of the Ministry of Health and the leadership of the national laboratories. The last thing, of course, is that the East is very alienated politically from the coalition that runs this country. This is this problem is not going to go away. It's one that requires much higher leadership from the member states of the Security Council. It's going to require more leadership among the states, heads of state of Southern and Central Africa, who have a huge amount at stake here. Keep in mind, back in 1997-98, when DRC went into a full-blown, full implosion, in which you had somewhere in the 13 different armies on the soil of Congo in that period, and generated the death of estimated millions and displacement of millions. And it took years to bring things back together again.
That was J. Stephen Morrison of the Center for Strategic and International Studies talking with my colleague Paul Alexander. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization, in partnership with the Ugandan government, has intensified measures to prevent the spread of Ebola at the border with the Democratic Republic of Congo. This comes as groups of DRC nationals cross into Uganda, fleeing uncertainty about last Sunday's election. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Wilson Agaba is the council chairperson of Isango sub-county in Uganda's Kasese district, where many Congolese refugees have pitched camp.
In fear of what is likely to be the outcome after the elections, people have decided to truck into Uganda through various roads in Isango. Given the fact that the borders are porous, there are so many roads, so people come in at any time they wish.
Some DRC residents fear there may be violence after the vote results are announced in the coming days. The concern is that Congolese refugees present a risk that the Ebola virus will spread from the DRC to Uganda. For the past 4 months, the DRC has been battling a deadly Ebola outbreak in the North Kivu and Ituri provinces. More than 600 cases have been reported. Uganda already has a number of Ebola screening centers at official entry points at the border to prevent the spread of the hemorrhagic fever. However, these Congolese refugees are coming in through unofficial routes and are mingling with Ugandans without being screened for Ebola. Agaba says local authorities are asking community residents to identify any newcomers so that health teams can check them.
Whoever sees somebody coming through those routes, please, you should inform the authorities so that these people could be directed back and pass through the screening area.
The Ugandan army has been deployed at the border to ensure any DRC national are screened. Bright Ramirama is Uganda's defense minister.
Our troops are on the border and helping civilians who are running away from unrest in Congo. And as they do so, we prepare our medical teams to make sure that they screen these people, working with Ministry of Health, to make sure that transit routes and high-risk areas, especially where there is a concentration of refugees in the camps, are monitored very well.
The World Health Organization is vaccinating soldiers at the border to protect them from the Ebola virus. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus is the WHO Director General, and he has been in Uganda over the past few days.
UPDF, of course, they were part of the vaccination, and some of their members were vaccinated. And based on the risks they face, we will continue to do that. Those who may have contacts and risks has to be vaccinated.
More than 100 Congolese are said to be camping in the areas of Kishororo, Kithoruhu, Isango, and Nyabugando, which neighbor the DRC. A temporary refugee camp has been established to host the Congolese as the world awaits the outcome of the DRC elections. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
a U.S. dragnet appears to be closing around a major case of financial fraud in Mozambique. Four people, including a former finance minister, have been arrested for alleged crimes related to a $2 billion loan the nation took out secretly in 2013 and 2014. Disclosure of the loan in 2016 triggered a massive debt crisis in the South African nation. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
It sounds like a Hollywood caper. A group of London bankers, international investors, and government officials spun tales of state companies desperate for loans in a resource-rich nation trying to rebuild after a bruising civil war. Their tales netted loans of $2 billion, which quickly disappeared. Then this caper turns tragic. The government, not knowing it was $2 billion in debt, operated as usual until 2016, when the loan was discovered. The government defaulted, triggering an economic crisis. The currency tumbled, prices rose, and hospitals ran out of basic supplies. This isn't Hollywood. This, allegedly, is Mozambique, according to an indictment that has resulted in the arrests of at least four people now awaiting extradition to the United States for their role in defrauding U.S. investors. VOA obtained a redacted copy of the indictment issued by the U.S. District Court's Eastern District of New York. It accuses the four, plus another man who has not been arrested, and two others who were not named, of creating projects as facades to raise money to enrich and pay bribes to themselves, Mozambican officials, and others. Last week, officials in South Africa arrested Mozambique's former finance minister, Manuel Chang, on an Interpol warrant. He faces possible extradition to the U.S. This, says analyst Alex Vines of the Chatham House Research Group, is a very big deal.
So it looked as if nothing would happen about these many millions, probably billions of U.S. dollars that were accounted for. So the indictment that has occurred from the U.S. District Court, Eastern District of New York, for key characters involved in this undisclosed loan scandal is very, very significant and is a game changer, I think.
That's certainly the case in Mozambique, where commentator Fernando Lima notes the public is largely applauding the arrests, while the ruling Frelimo party remains silent.
It caused this huge, huge embarrassment for the current government. Up to now, which is also very, very surprising, no Mozambican authorities have said anything related to the arrest of Mr. Chang. Neither the government, neither Frelimo party, neither the Attorney General office, or our parliament.
Vine says it's not clear how President Filipe Nyusi, who was defense minister at the time of the loans, will emerge from the scandal, but added there may be a bright side for investors who are eager to put money into the nation, which will start exporting natural gas in 2023.
The International Monetary Fund, IMF, and bilateral donors to Mozambique had suspended lending to Mozambique, or direct government lending, should I say. They do want to move on. And so, again, I think this might help clear things up so that longer term, the relationship of Mozambique with some of its international creditors and international partners can be improved.
Rudy Kraus, the South African lawyer representing former Finance Minister Chang, says they'll fight the U.S. extradition request. Kraus said attorneys had not been given a full copy of the indictment by South African officials at the time of Chang's arrest, and so could not comment on the allegations. VOA was unable to reach Kraus after receiving the American copy of the indictment for further comment. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
19 past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A witness tells VOA's French service that at least 48 people have died after an attack early this week in Burkina Faso ignited widespread intercommunal violence. The witness said many of the victims were from the Fulani ethnic group. Speaking over the phone with VOA, the witness, who requested to remain anonymous because of security concerns, said he had counted up to 48 dead bodies. The official death toll released Wednesday was 16, but some officials privately say the number is close to 40. The first attack was in the town of Yirgu, on Monday in north-central Burkina Faso. Other villages were hit in retaliation over the next few days. The witness who spoke to VOA said a local defense group burned the homes of the Fulani ethnic group and killed Fulani men. Burkina Faso has been hit by outbreaks of sectarian and ethnic violence over the past several years. Islamist groups linked with Al-Qaeda and other organizations are seeking territory, while rival ethnic groups battle over scarce water, grazing land, and other resources. The Interior Ministry of the Government of National Accord in Libya has announced that the director of the Tripoli security and his Benghazi counterpart have agreed to unify their security agencies. The new initiative also calls for creating a joint media directorate free from political friction and disputes. Rhiannon Smith is the managing editor of the Libya Analysis Research Group in London. She talked with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi about the significance of these developments and how they might improve the prospects of success for the coming National Libyan Dialogue.
Symbolically, this agreement is very important, actually. So this is the first time these two parallel and rival institutions, so the Ministry of Interior in the east, aligned with the Libyan National Army, and the Ministry of Interior under the Government of National Accord in Tripoli, have actually publicly said that they will work together and have publicly stated they're going to try and reunify these institutions. That said, it's likely to take some time to implement real changes. And in Libya, often committees are formed and decisions are made, but nothing actually happens on the ground. But I think this move does show a willingness among these different security actors to work together and to try and form some sort of de facto reconciliation. And I think the key thing about this is it is a bottom-up approach. It's showing that not just the military structures, but also the security, the police, these kind of structures are willing to try and work together to create some platform where reconciliation can happen. So I think this is a positive first step, which could underpin a wider political and military reunification at some point in the next year, hopefully.
The new initiative is also calling for unifying the media discourse through a joint media directorate free from political friction and disputes. How important is this to the upcoming National Dialogue Conference in Libya?
So in Libya, the kind of media bias, the misinformation, the so-called fake news is a massive issue, and actually it drives a lot of tension and conflict in Libya. It led to a deepening of the polarization between different political elements in Libya, between the east and west of the country, between lots of rival political and military actors. So the need to kind of have a unified media discourse, to have some sort of independence and verification in the media, is very important. The government institutions, the different security apparatus are very bad at maintaining a narrative, at communicating honestly and openly. Often you'll have many conflicting messages from one individual government department, and this drives a lot of mistrust among Libyans and their trust in what their governments are going to do. So trying to establish some kind of openness and unification in the media, I think, is very important. And mainly that's so that people have a greater trust in these institutions as they're trying to kind of find a way to reconcile the different divided populations within Libya.
The Libyan government said other committees will be formed to draft overall national security strategies and to study restructuring the Interior Ministry as a prelude to unifying the executive authority in Libya. Is that a breakthrough in the deadlocked Libyan crisis?
This does appear to be different in the sense that rather than being really led or visibly led by an external power, so the international community or the UN, this does seem to be a certain amount of organic reconciliation that there has been in recent weeks. Incidences of the LNA and GNA aligned forces working together, for example, in the oil crescent, and also coordinating on issues such as customs decisions at ports across the country. So there does seem to be a growing foundation of, if not official, then de facto kind of reconciliation and talks between some of these divided entities. So I think the fact that the government is coming out, or both kind of sides of the government are coming out and publicly saying that they are going to try and work towards reunifying the Interior Ministry and other entities is very important. There will still be a lot of stepping stones and divides along the way. For example, on the military side, the issue of whether Khalifa Haftar or who else would be the kind of supreme commander is an ongoing issue. But overall, I think that this move and these statements are symbolically important. And if they keep going in this direction, they could lay a solid foundation for a bottom-up approach to the political reconciliation and the national conference, which is kind of more of a top-down approach politically.
That was Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis. She spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shinawi. After an official inauguration last month, Senegal finally opened the Museum of Black Civilizations to the general public this week. Ricky Shryock has more from the capital, Dakar.
Senegal's Museum of Black Civilizations is now open to the public. The four-story structure is home to one of Africa's largest art collections and has room for 18,000 works in all. Visitors on the first day, like Solange Lopez, expressed enthusiasm for the new institution. She says she loves it, and it is really impressive. It is really magnificent to have so much African art brought together here, she says, because it is from here. It is from Africa. The museum opening comes amid global calls for European countries to return African art looted during the colonial era. A recent report commissioned by French President Emmanuel Macron identified 46,000 objects at the Musée du Quai Branly Museum in Paris that would qualify for repatriation. Corinne John from Texas visited the museum on opening day with her husband, Amdalai John, who grew up in Senegal. She thinks the museum would be a great spot for visitors to see African art on the African continent. She says European countries should return the artifacts.
This is the time to do it. I think this will be a great way to be able to bring the African art back to Africa and give people a central location that they can go and see.
Museum Director Hamadi Bokhum says the museum will be a space for conversation on a global scale.
Le défi c'était de créer un langage particulier et
profond. The museum is not for Senegal or just Africa or the diaspora, he says. It is a museum of black civilizations throughout the world. It has to be a space where we celebrate black culture, he says, but also a space where the black cultures dialogue with other cultures. With contemporary exhibits at the museum as well, artists from Dakar hope the Museum of Black Civilizations can also lend exposure to the city's vibrant contemporary art scene. Senegalese visual artist Djibril Drame says he thinks the global spotlight on Dakar can help local artists. The museum is new, but already it has international coverage that can bring them a lot of credibility, he says, for Senegalese artists and contemporary African artists. For now, the new museum's workers are happy to welcome visitors. Soon, many in Senegal and beyond hope the museum can also welcome African art back to the continent. Ricky Shryock for VOA News, Dakar.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, stay tuned to the sunny side of sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.